I'm Celia, here with our first Young Scientist Spotlight of 2022. In these episodes, we get to hear stories from the up-and-comers behind the research that's about to shake up the scientific universe. I had the absolute pleasure of talking with Emma Harding. She's a PhD student at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, which means we met over Zoom. It was a Friday afternoon for me, but a Saturday morning for her. Time zones are super weird, but we made it work. She's a paleovirologist, which means she studies ancient viruses and how they evolve, and she told me all about fossils, but probably not the kind you're thinking of. We also talked about marsupial genes and how sometimes failing at one project just opens doors to new ones. And if you listen closely, you might hear the soothing sounds of nature behind her. It's some free ASMR. You're welcome. Emma's wonderful. I'm so excited for you to meet her. Enjoy.
This is
Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
Yeah, so my name's Emma Harding. I go by she or her. And I am currently a third year PhD candidate at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. For as long as I can remember, I've loved science. And I became quite well known by my primary school librarian as that like 4-year-old kid that checks out all the books on astronomy and planets and things. I loved space for a long time, and I loved dinosaurs. And also media, like books and things, and Jurassic Park was a big thing for me. I just ate it all up like crazy as a kid. And especially in the second Jurassic Park movie, there's actually a character called Dr. Harding, and that's my last name, and so I just linked with that, and I'm like, that's going to be me one day. And it's not so much that I found a passion for science, it's that I always had it, and it was never dissuaded. Everything I've found out about science has just made me more and more keen to do it and make it my life. And I just stumbled across microbiology, which is studying how you get sick. Because I think it's amazing that the body has so many systems to keep you safe and you don't even know that they're happening every day. But what's more interesting is how these microbes get around that. Because our body's so complex, they have to be so creative in a sense to make us sick and to be successful, and just that constant little arms race between us and them without us knowing in our everyday life is fascinating to me.
Do you find yourself sometimes rooting for the microbes even though you know that they can make us sick?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Whenever I get a cold, I'm like, oh, it's doing well today, isn't it?
That's so funny. So I know that the thing that you study is called paleovirology, which is a word that I had never heard of before until I was looking it up. So in your words, like, what is paleovirology and why is it cool?
It's like studying the dinosaurs of viruses. So we have a really small snapshot of what's around us at the moment, like what makes us sick. So it's influenza virus or rabies or things like that. But what we don't realize is that viruses have been around forever. There's a group of scientists, myself included, that think viruses may have even been around before life, like before the first cell. They were the precursor. And there's this whole gap that we're missing of information in what these viruses looked like and what they did and how they shaped how we evolved. For example, there's an old retrovirus that integrated into our DNA that we still have with us that led to the formation of the placenta. And that was a big jump in evolution from kangaroos with pouches to mice and humans and elephants and things. So we don't know what viruses have done and how they've helped us or harmed us. And I think it's just such a fascinating field to look into because there's so much to explore.
What is a virus exactly? Like, what are they made out of? Are they alive? And how is it possible to study them when they're that old? Because I think in my head, I understand the concept of paleontology. Like, we can look at fossils of bones and stuff. Those are like objects, but viruses are so tiny and imperceptible in my brain that I don't really understand.
So what you ask is actually a very loaded question, if they're alive or not. There's a lot of debate on that. I think not. To be alive, generally, you have to have criteria that you fit, which viruses don't. You can think of them very simply as just a bunch of information or instructions surrounded by a shell, like a little spaceship. So it floats through space or through over your desk or through the air when you sneeze, just waiting to land in the right place, and then it colonizes. So it can't do anything by itself, which is why a lot of people say they're not alive. But because it's so simple, it means that it's quite easy to predict what it does. For example, we see all these patterns in viruses. We know that every virus must have this particular gene. It must have that kind of shape. It must have this and it must have that, because you can think of them, because they're so small, real estate is very expensive for them. They can't afford to have unnecessary genes or unnecessary things going on. So it's quite easy to look at something and go, yes, that's a virus, and that's not, because they all follow these patterns. So when you're looking at the fossils and the really ancient ones, it's all pattern recognition. And you're saying, what do we see in viruses these days? What do they have in common? We see the same thing over there. That must be an old virus.
So when you say a fossil of a virus, is the fossil of a virus something that I could find in my body right now?
It's definitely something you can find now. So the interesting thing about the viral fossils is they're not preserved in rock or in the ground like normal fossils. They're preserved in our genes and in our DNA. So our body kind of keeps them alive in a sense and passes them on over the generations pretty much intact, which is why we can still see these patterns of genes that we would expect to see in a normal virus, but they're integrated deep in between two human genes where you wouldn't expect to find them. But in that little sandwich, they're quite nicely preserved and they'll just be passed on from parent to child over and over without much change. And so in that way, they're nicely presented for us to study.
Are these things that would maybe jump from, like, a dinosaur had the flu a gazillion years ago and now I could get the same kind of flu that that dinosaur has?
Good question. We're still trying to figure that out, but generally they don't jump too much. Take the dinosaur example. We only know a few viruses that jump from birds to humans, which is like avian influenza. It would be similar with the dinosaur viruses, we would think. So they'd have their own set of flu, coronavirus, herpes, HIV, dinosaur specific, and then the early mammals would have their own set of viruses, and frogs would have their own set, and they'd very much be segregated.
Going through the line of human history, how much are these viruses evolving?
So we can definitely use looking at apes to see what has been with us as humans over the last 100 million years. So as we have changed, so have the viruses. And we can trace that back and say, okay, this virus seemed to be really prevalent when we were still in the trees. And then there's no evidence of it after that, so we must have overcome it or it changed.
It sounds like there are some viruses, maybe like HIV, that we've been unable to get around forever and ever. And then there are some that maybe we have figured out how to beat, or our immune systems have just changed. Can you maybe give an example of a virus that has been around for all or most of human history?
I also like to look at amphibians and reptiles because they're, in a sense, more primitive than us. And so the viruses that infect them are a bit more primitive. And you can see how the viruses have become more complex to keep up with our immune system. So there's a type of virus called papillomavirus, or HPV, human papillomavirus. It causes cervical cancer. There's a long history of papillomaviruses throughout evolution, and when you look at the ones that infect frogs and amphibians, they've got four genes. So you can think of them as being this long. Really simple.
We did this over Zoom, and since we could see each other's faces at the time, Emma used her hands to measure out a teeny amount of space, like saying these virus genes are short.
Then you look at the ones that infect us and the ones in our fossil record of viruses, they're about this big.
So now imagine Emma's arms outstretched, like, I caught a fish and it was huge! That big.
They have many more genes, and those genes are all to do with suppressing our immune system and escaping from our immune system. So there's definitely evidence that a lot of viruses had to adapt to be able to keep infecting us as we evolved better and better defenses. There's not any viruses that we've completely beaten, because they always come back bigger and better. It just might take them a little bit of time to think of a new strategy.
What are some examples of ways that a virus might level up? Like, what are some of the things that it would be evolving to overcome?
A lot of viruses have envelopes, including SARS-CoV-2. It kind of steals the outside of our cell and hides in it. So if you can imagine all of our cells wearing a coat, which says, I belong to human, the virus, as it leaves the cell, takes a bit of that coat and wraps itself up, so that the immune system doesn't recognize it and goes along and says, yep, you're wearing a coat, perfect, I'll leave you all alone. So there's some really, really fascinating ways that viruses can tweak what normally happens to their advantage.
It's so crazy to me whenever I hear about viruses, knowing that they don't have brains. But they've still evolved to figure this stuff out. It's so hard to, like, at least for me, not anthropomorphize them. Do you find yourself doing that ever? Like, do you feel like you are anthropomorphizing the things that you study?
All the time, every day. And that's actually what I love about it, is the fact that it's so hard to grasp that it's not making choices, but it seems to be making all the right choices. And just thinking about that every day is kind of humbling, in a sense, that you think the universe is so big and so complex without us being here.
Speaking of the vastness and complexity of our world, another thing Emma studies is the global virome, another term I had never heard of until I fell down this paleovirology rabbit hole with her.
Kind of in the sense that we say a microbiome, if you've heard of that, like, your gut microbiome is all of the bacteria and things living in your gut and good for digestion. The virome is all of the viruses living in a particular place. So the global virome is just a really fancy way of saying what viruses are in the world as a whole. And it's more and more important these days to understand that, because we're seeing so many zoonotic viruses that jump from other species into humans. So we pretty much know what you're going to get from a human. You're going to get a cold, you can get herpes, like a cold sore if you kiss the wrong person, you can get EB, that kind of stuff. But what we need to focus on, I think, is the stuff we don't know that could come from bats, from rats, from mice, from birds. And there's not really much information on what's out there. If you were to sample, and we do this sometimes, we just sample an animal from the bush and sequence it and have a look at what viruses are in there. Most of them are going to be new and never before discovered or visualized. And there's just so much diversity out there yet to be found. From a evolution perspective, which is what I love, it will fill in a lot of gaps. But from a health perspective, it's definitely the first step in predicting future pandemics and understanding what's circulating out there and what people are going to be coming into contact with in the future, and helping trying to prepare for that.
That sounds so overwhelming as a research prospect, because in my head I'm thinking of the census, right? Like in the US at least, where you would go through and somebody will find every single person in every single house and ask them basic questions about their demographics. And it seems like that's not possible to do with viruses. Like, you can't sample every single animal and be like, excuse me, sir, what viruses are living inside of you today? And if every time you sample an animal, you're like, oh God, there's a gazillion things that we hadn't thought of yet in this one. How, like, how do you know how many viruses there are?
Yeah, that is the question, really. Yeah, a lot of people did start with the thing of, let's go out, let's catch a fox, let's sample it. Okay, we've got 10 more viruses, let's catch another fox. And they realize that's just going to take so long. So people are turning to things like environmental DNA and RNA now, which is where you can take a sample from a waterhole or something, and that way you're actually getting every animal that drank there, so you're getting a wider population. We're looking more towards stuff like that, where you can minimize having to find and hunt all the viruses. You can just have them come to a central point and sample that. That's going to be the best shot at doing it, but yeah, it is a bit of an impossible task. You've just got to try and get started and see where it takes you, but it's not something that's ever going to be finished.
I understand this now, maybe a little bit in the very big picture, but on a day-to-day basis, like, what are you doing? You said that you're a third year PhD student, so I imagine that means you're doing quite a bit of lab work.
I would be if it wasn't for lockdowns. I haven't actually been able to do too much in the last 2 years, lab-wise.
Right. So in theory, so say that you weren't, you know, trapped in your house escaping the overrepresented virus in our global virome right now, what would you be doing?
Yeah, so I'd probably be picking a few viruses of interest or viral fossils of interest and experimenting with them in cell culture. It's the main way of replicating viruses. Like I said, they can't do anything without a cell. They just float around. So we need to grow them in a cell. So we have mammalian cells, which are just like if you take a cheek swab and put it on a petri dish and you grow it. That's basically it. And we can infect them with viruses and see what happens. And we can mutate those viruses and we can put it under different selection pressures. Like, we can put in some antiviral drugs and see if the viruses survive or not. So in particular, what I'm really interested in is these viral fossils doing something in our cells. So they're so old, we know that they don't make virus at this point. They're still making these things called small RNA molecules, which are part of our cells' normal workings. I would really love to prove that that's helpful to us, and we've kept them as a kind of vaccine that you can inherit throughout generations. So what I would do is I would get cells and turn these viral fossils on and off and see the difference when I then go to try and infect the cells, if they're protected with this fossil on or less protected with it off. And it's a lot of, you can think of it as switches, and you just try all the different combinations and see the end result, if the cell dies or not.
Would it be possible to maybe in the future just be like, hey, cell, turn on the vaccine that you already have, and now you won't get this disease? Would that maybe be a future treatment for things?
Yes, I think that's definitely possible. It would take a lot of time, but we couldn't leave it up to our cells, that's for sure, to choose the right time. But there's definitely a possibility that we could engineer, in a sense, these little, if we take the viral fossils as a template and say, okay, this is a fossil for HIV, we want to make it for coronavirus, we'll just copy that template and put it into our cells and then switch it on. I don't see why that couldn't work.
Of course, it was impossible to have a conversation about viruses, especially viral fossils that might literally be vaccines that already exist inside of our bodies, without talking about the thing powering a bunch of our COVID vaccines, mRNA.
So mRNA is normal part of our cell. The explanation I love to give is our DNA is a cookbook, and the mRNA is the post-it note that you write your notes on, because you don't want your cookbook to get ruined, and you take that post-it note into the kitchen and that's what you cook with, and you spill flour and stuff on that. And the proteins that your cells make are the cake, the end result. So you've got your master copy DNA cookbook safe and stored away, and your little post-it note you throw out afterwards. You just need it for that one recipe. So that's what mRNA is normally. It's like a temporary messenger thing, so that your DNA isn't out and about near the oil and the flour and the butter, but you're still getting the message where it needs to go. So the vaccines that we have at the moment are that temporary thing. They do what they need to do. They let your cell bake the cake, which in this case is the spike protein, and then they dissolve. Small RNA is similarly a very temporary molecule, so it's only lasts for a few hours. But instead of turning into a protein or turning into a cake, its whole role, as far as we know, is to help protect our cells from foreign things. It has also been implicated in development. When I said switching things on and off, the way our cells do that is with these temporary molecules that go and bind to something or go and open something up or turn something on and then vanish, because we don't want something turned on all the time. Or you can think of it simply as how an eyeball and a finger have the exact same DNA, but they look different and they do different things. That's because of RNA.
Even though scientists' understanding of RNA brought us some pretty great vaccines, COVID restrictions had Emma locked down at home away from lab for a pretty long time. While she was stuck at home with no actual viruses to play with, she took advantage of something she did have, a computer.
I was doing something called bioinformatics, which is simply the use of a computer to analyze biological data. So when we sequence something, so we take a sample of liver or something like tissue, and we sequence it to find all the A's, T's, C's and G's, so the DNA sequence, that's then gigabytes, sometimes terabytes of A's, T's, C's and G's. And the process of pulling out meaningful information from that is bioinformatics. We have this workflow of programs where you put it into one program, it does something, and the output goes into the next program and it does something, and the output goes into the next. It's like a big chain of analysis that all gives you graphs and things at the end. And you have to look at it and think, is this proving what I'm trying to prove? Or is this saying that my hypothesis is rubbish? And if it's rubbish, which it most often is, what do I need to then analyze? So I then need to pick my next lot of things and run that through the workflow.
So you say that you can start with just a sample of some tissue and you're looking at its DNA sequences, blah, 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 blah. You boopity boop it through all of the steps. And then what are you looking at the end, and what kind of information is it telling you?
To start off with, I look at a genome of something. So that's every single ATC and G in a particular organism. So the human genome has been done to death. I'm going to leave that alone for a little bit because so many people work on it. But I look at marsupials for that. So I take a marsupial genome and I run it through the workflow to look for these viral fossils. And like I mentioned before, that's all pattern recognition. So we're looking for parts of the DNA or the A's, T's, C's and G's which match up with the A's, T's, C's and G's that we'd find in a virus. So at the very end of that, I get a really long list of sometimes about 16,000 hits, we call them. And so it'll say, okay, this part on chromosome 1 between base 3 and 190 looks like Ebola virus. It's that kind of stuff. once I've got a little short list of ones I'm interested in, I then move on to look at what are they doing in our cells. So we don't care about the DNA anymore, we care about the temporary messages. And I want to see if any of these fossils are being converted into temporary messages, because that means they might be sending the message to something and doing something. And then I want to have a look at the specificity of tissues. So say, for example, there's an HIV fossil that's turned on and is actually being made into RNA in a brain cell. Is that also being made into RNA in a liver cell of the same animal and a spleen of the same animal, or is it just the brain? But I'm doing this over multiple animals, over multiple species and multiple tissues.
So speaking of all of these animals, all of the animals that you work with seem extremely Australian, at least, you know, from my Californian perspective. It's a lot of like marsupials and cane toads. Is your focus on those organisms just because they happen to be around, or is there something exceptionally interesting about them? Or maybe, like, is Australia just a really great place to be doing paleovirology research? Like, what's up with all that?
Yeah, it's definitely a bit of a combination. It's what's easiest to get, the possum in your backyard kind of thing. but Australia has been isolated. It's quite unique in that it's an island in the middle of nowhere. Which is really annoying when we're trying to go on holiday because plane tickets are very expensive. But it's really good when you're studying what lives here because it's been left alone for hundreds of millions of years. But from my point of view, if we have such weird big animals, imagine the weird viruses that we have. Millions of years left alone, what kind of things would come out of that? Some of the strangest things will be here because there's been not much mingling. Whereas somewhere like America, you'd have mingling between north and south. You'd have probably some mingling across Alaska to Russia, maybe with some birds that are flying over there. So you'll get a kind of equilibrium of strange things, normal things, and they'll meet in the middle. Whereas in Australia, it can just kind of keep getting stranger and stranger and stranger and stranger, and nothing's going to stop it.
I hate to be one of those people who's like, but what does it have to do with humans? But I am curious how, if at all, does understanding kind of the evolution of these viruses and marsupials, does that tell us anything about the evolution of viruses in humans?
Yeah, it definitely tells us general stuff. One of the big things, I think, is paleovirology has really only been a field for about 10 years. So the first viral fossil was discovered in 2011. And so a lot of people that are doing this don't really know what they're doing, myself included, when I started. So a lot of the groundwork is just making the computer programs and making the methods for how you study this stuff. So a lot of it, in a sense, it doesn't matter what you pick. You're going to be creating the groundwork for human studies later on. A great thing that this is could be used for is antiviral development, or something called broad-spectrum antivirals. So antibiotics treat bacteria. You have broad-spectrum ones where you don't even need to know what you're sick with. We just give you the pill and you take it and you're cured. So they work against a range of species. With viruses, that doesn't really work because they are so different to each other. There's not one pill that can treat seven viruses. It's usually very, very specific. So we need to know exactly what you are sick with, and then we can treat it. We want to try and change that to be more broad-acting. So in order to do that, we need to find what viruses have in common. So to find that, we can look through the fossils. Over millions of years, is there parts of them that have never changed, that are always in a virus? And if so, let's target that, because we know that's going to stay the same into the future as well. So we won't have issues of antiviral resistance as much if we can find these overlapping regions that all viruses have. That's what we want to be targeting our drugs for in the future. And that would be one great application.
It's so exciting to be basically like right at the very beginning of this field. I didn't realize that it was so recent. So like, how did it come up then? If it's only been around for about a decade, did somebody 10 years ago, or in 2011, I guess now almost 11 years ago, did someone just say like, hey guys, I figured out there's these viral fossils, what's up with that? And then a bunch of people followed, or was it more complicated than that?
Yeah, it's actually quite a funny story. So my supervisor came in one day and said, why don't we have a look at viruses in marsupials? Because a lot of them are quite endangered, these species. So it's nice to know what is around so we can start thinking about if they get sick, we at least have a short list of what it could be. So I was like, yeah, let's do it. Let's look at viral fossils. So I looked through their transcriptomes, which is all their RNA, so their messages. So it's looking at about 35 weeks, and I found no viruses, which was a bit of a bummer because this was 3/4 of my thesis year done now. But what I was finding is these really small bits which looked similar to viruses, but they were nowhere near long enough to be a virus. And I was like, why am I finding this same sequence over and over again in all these different species? And so I started looking into what this was, and it turned out it was a fragment of an ancient virus. So I kind of became the lab expert, in a sense, on this, just because I, to start off with, had nothing else to do because I didn't find what I was initially searching for. But as I read up on it and I discovered this field, I thought it was amazing. And I was getting so much of these fossils in my data without even realizing it. I thought, how many other people are doing this as well? And you know, this is something big that we can really look into. And since then, I've just loved it.
Well, speaking of loving it, what's your favorite part about your research or your job generally?
My favorite part definitely is the research and just having some days where you get that graph back and you realize something and you're the only person in the world that knows that because you just did that analysis and you just have that result. And then you go and tell your supervisor and your peers and you write it up and things, but there's a brief moment where you know something that no one else knows and you've just discovered something new. And the fact that that happens almost every day is just such a great feeling and it's very exciting. So I love that.
This episode was produced by me, Celia Ford, with help from the team at Carry the One Radio. This episode was supported by the Office of University Development and Alumni Relations at UCSF. And an extra big thank you to our Patreon supporters, including Anne Colton, Mark Kunitomi, Catherine Batchelor, Carly Van Orsdell, Merrill Horn, Levi Kai, Stephanie Redmond, Paul Breslin, Karun Amita, and Columbo Ahmed. If you have a little extra cash floating around, please send some of it our way. Contributing just $1 an episode helps a lot, and that's like a fifth of a cold brew. Your donations make our science communication possible, and we appreciate you so much. We also appreciate comments and reviews so much, so let us know what you think. And if you need more science content, you can find all of our episodes on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Stay healthy, stay sane, and stay curious.